Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello. We're continuing our study of Exodus. We're going to be in chapter 4 today. Please remember that chapter 3 and 4 form a literary unit. The excuses of Moses that begin in chapter 3, the confrontation, the burning bush, continue in chapter 4. But some new things are developed, and so we're going to cover this chapter separately as we did chapter 3. Now notice verse 1, if you would, please. When Moses answered and said, "What if they will not believe me?" Well, God has told him in chapter 3, verse 18, that he's going to be with him, and they will pay heed to what you say. But I think Moses remembered the agony and the pain back in chapter 2, verse 14, where they said, "Who made you ruler over us?" when he was trying to help two of his countrymen. And I think he wants to make sure that they're going to do that. Now, in verse 30, it's obvious that these three signs that God's going to give him, he's going to give him one in verse 2, a staff that turns into a snake. The second in verse 6, his hand that when he puts it into the fold of his garment becomes leprous. That's going to be in verse 6. And some water from the Nile will turn to blood. That's going to be in verse 9. These three signs are apparently done before the people in verse 30, for it says that Aaron worked all these signs before them, and they believed. Now, the staff becoming a snake was done before Pharaoh in chapter 7, verses 9 and 10. The leprosy thing was never done that we know of, except in Numbers 12 in connection with Miriam's kind of revolt against Moses. And, of course, the Nile turning to blood, that was one of the signs used in the plagues. And the reason for that was because the Nile was the chief deity of Egypt. And every one of these plagues is going to kind of put down an Egyptian deity and prove that Yahweh is the only God. Some have even asserted that the word serpent here is possibly a cobra, which is on the headpiece of the Pharaoh and symbolized his power. And maybe that's why this serpent was done. But of course, as you know later on, the magicians will be able to duplicate this staff turning into a snake. Although Moses' snake will eat theirs, they still do it. Now, so these are signs to help the people believe and to convince Pharaoh also that the Lord has not appeared to you. And the Lord said to him, "What is that in your hand?" And he said, "A staff." Now, Moses believed this is a shepherd's staff, alluded to in Psalm 23:4, a crooked kind of staff used to help herd the sheep and protect them and gather them. Now, it was not used for protection because a rod, a club they wore on their belt, was used for protection. This was used more for guidance. And so that's probably what it is. Some say Moses wouldn't appear before Pharaoh with the implement of a profession that the Egyptians despised. Why not? Why not? Threw it on the ground. He threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent. This is a different name for serpent than is used later on in the account where it actually happened before Pharaoh. And why the two different names for serpent, I'm not sure. And Moses fled from it. I guess he did. Apparently he thought it was poisonous, so maybe it was a cobra. And the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand and grasp it by the tail. I like Ken Miedemann's account of this. You don't grab a poisonous snake by the tail. It was a real act of faith for Moses to grab this serpent by the tail, and it became a rod again in Moses' hand, of course. That they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, verse 5. That's interesting because back in chapter 3, verse 6, it's the God of your father, meaning, I think, his slave father. But here is the usual way this phrase runs. It's the covenant God of your family, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of the covenant between Abraham. And I think that's the significance here. And the Lord furthermore said to him, put your hand into your bosom. Now, that he would have a robe on, and that seems to be to thrust it in towards your chest. Okay? So he put his hand into his bosom and pulled it out, and behold, it was leprous like snow. Now, we learn from Leviticus chapter 13, verse 4, that leprosy is a horrible skin disease. And it's the characteristic of this kind of leprosy is a white skin. The white patches, it then turns the hair white and becomes a kind of a glaze over the whole body, a very terrible disease. It came to be kind of a divine sickness. Somebody who had it was seen to be cursed by God. But here it's going to be used as a sign. We know it was used of Miriam getting sick because she rebelled against Moses, apparently marrying a black wife in Numbers 12. In Numbers 12:10 is where Miriam had to pray to be turned dark again. I think God has a little sense of humor there. And he said, put your hand in your bosom again. And he put his hand in again and took it out. And behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. Some say that Moses originally had leprosy and God healed him here, but I think that's just ridiculous. It just goes far what this text says. Now here's number 9, the last sign. But it shall be that if they will not believe even these two signs or heed what you say, then you shall take some water from the Nile. Now remember that the Pharaoh was considered to be the son of the sun god Ra, and the Nile was the chief deity in this pantheon of gods of Egypt. Pour it on dry ground, and the water which you take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. Now, of course, we know that this happened to the entire Nile River. It's possible this happened sometime from one of the tributaries going through Ethiopia, that some redness comes into it because of the terrain washing some of the red dirt in the river. But, of course, how would it happen in a cup that was taken from the Nile? This is obviously supernatural. Now, throughout these plagues, some of them are natural occurrences, but with supernatural timing, intensity, and geographical location. So it's obviously a miracle, even though God used a natural means. Now, and Moses said to the Lord, please, Lord, I have not been eloquent either recently nor in times past, nor since thou hast spoken to thy servant, for I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. I think we need to say something here about Moses. He is making a series of excuses. He did feel inadequate to do this, as all of God's leaders did. But what God is saying is, I didn't promise to make you eloquent. I promised to make you effective. Now, boy, God's preachers need to hear that. Not everybody's going to be a great preacher. But if you preach the good news, everybody can be an effective proclaimer of who God is in our world. You might want to see 2 Corinthians 10:10, where Paul also was not a very good speaker. God uses the weak of this world to confound the wise. The Lord said to him, who has made man's mouth? Or who makes him dumb or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? What God says is, Moses, if I call you, I'll equip you for the task. Now, let's get on with this. I've told you what I want you to do, and I want you to do it. And Moses still hum-hawing around, and God says, look, what I called you to do, I'll prepare you to do. Now, then go, and I, even I, will be with your mouth. What a wonderful promise. I will be with your mouth and teach you what you are to say. And he said, please, Lord, now send the message by whomever you will. Now, that seems like he's capitulating to God's will. But in Hebrew, what he's saying is, God, find somebody else. God, not me. I've run out of excuses, God. I just don't want to do it. And God became angry with Moses. The anger of the Lord burned against Moses. God is depicted in human terms, and love and anger are both human terms, and it's represented here. Here comes your brother Aaron the Levite. Why call Aaron a Levite? Isn't Moses a Levite? Some say it's in the sense of teacher, Aaron the teacher, which meant that he was fluent in the way he spoke, eloquent speaker. That may be true, we just don't know. Some may be reading something that happened later, the Levites coming out of Aaron back into an older passage. That's possible. I know he speaks fluently, and moreover, he is coming. God had already spoken to Aaron, apparently, in the land of Egypt, and he was coming to meet Moses. God told him, apparently, where to come. He probably came at Pharaoh's death to get his brother. Let's see. Verse 15. And you are to speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I, even I, will be with your mouth and his mouth, and I will teach you what you are to do. I want to tell you that Moses wasn't an innovator, wasn't a religious genius. He is not inventing the revelation. He's just passing on the revelation. We need to hear that, I think. Moreover, he shall speak for you to the people, and it shall come about that he shall be a mouth for you, and you shall be as, or for, Elohim to him. This is an interesting use of the word Elohim. Elohim does not always mean God in the Old Testament. Sometimes it can mean angels. Sometimes even the judges of Israel are called Elohim. So it'd be like you'll be a spiritual superior to him. You'll be the true channel of revelation, but he'll be your helper. That's the idea here. You might want to see chapter 7, verse 1. And you shall take your staff in your hand, your staff, and this, you shall perform these signs. This staff is going to become the sign of God's power in Moses' hand. He will perform the plagues with this. He'll perform the providing water in the wilderness. He will split the Red Sea with his staff. It is God's staff. You might want to see verse 20, where it's even called the staff of God in his hand, a symbol of God's power. Now, notice when Moses departed and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law. Now, he's going to ask him permission to leave. This was Oriental etiquette. He doesn't tell him why. The rabbis say he was too modest. I don't know what the problem is. Maybe he didn't trust Jethro. Maybe he didn't want to have to explain all this because didn't want to perform the signs for Jethro. I'm not sure why. But he just tells Jethro he wants to go home. Jethro says, go in peace. And he said to Moses in Midian, go back to Egypt, and all the men who are seeking your life are dead. Okay? Well, that means that the Pharaoh, whichever Pharaoh that is, we're not 100% sure, but the Pharaoh of the oppression has died. So Moses took his wife, Zipporah, and his sons, plural. Now, we only know of one son from chapter 2, verse 22. That's the son Gershom. We learn later that there is an Eliezer, which is in chapter 18, verse 4. He may have been an infant at this time, but he's just not mentioned until 18:4. Mounted him on a donkey and returned to the land of Egypt. This is very similar to what's going to be used in Hosea chapter 11, verse 1, as a reference to the Messiah later on coming out of Egypt. Let's see. Moses took the staff of God in his hand. And Lord said to Moses, when you go back to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders which I have put in your power. And I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Now, this has really caused people miseries. They've just worried about this and worried about this. God's unfair. Let's talk about this for a minute. The heart is the seat of the entire personality, primarily the intellect. This was not an emotional decision that Pharaoh would make, but an intellectual decision. Now, in the Old Testament, there's only one source. God's the source of calamity as well as blessing. God is the source of darkness and light. There's only one source. So, of course, by saying God will harden Pharaoh's heart is not an unusual way of saying that. God knew what Pharaoh was going to do. It's either emphasis on foreknowledge. If you look at the Bible itself, Pharaoh hardened his own heart several times, and then God picked up and hardened his heart. Matter of fact, there are three different ways this is used. Three different verbs are used to describe this hardening. But three different ways. Sometimes it says that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. You see that in chapter 4:21, 7:3, 9:12, chapter 10, verses 1, verse 20, and verse 27, chapter 11, verse 10, chapter 14, verses 4 and 8, and particularly stated in Romans chapter 9, verses 14 through 18. Now, it also says that Pharaoh hardened his own heart, chapter 8, verse 15, chapter 8, verse 32, chapter 9, verse 34. Several times it just says Pharaoh's heart was hardened, but it doesn't say who the agent was. Chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. Chapter 7, verse 22. Chapter 18, 19. Chapter 9, verse 7 and 35. There are three different verbs used. I've shown them in your notes, and that should be enough. That basically are different words that are synonymous that speak of something becoming hardened or calcitrant or obstinate. Okay? Now, if God hardened his heart and Pharaoh had no choice, why is Pharaoh responsible? Friends, our lives, we're not puppets on a string. What God did when He created us, out of His own sovereignty, He gave us freedom of choice. And yet, God still knows what we will do, and He uses that knowledge. But, also notice that it's connected with redemption, okay? And not some being lost, but it's connected with the redemption of Israel. Israel will believe God, Egypt will not, though God will do many wonders against those Egyptian gods. This is the paradox that later developed in the tensions in the Bible, even between the sovereignty of God and the free will of man. I guess we can see so clearly in Romans chapter 9, one of the strongest chapters anywhere in the Bible, the sovereignty of God. I'm the potter, you're the clay. I love Jacob, I hated Esau, I hardened Pharaoh's heart. I'm God, thank you, I'll do what I want to. But then in Romans chapter 10 are more whosoever wills than any chapter in the Bible. And the two are never explained. They're paradoxes of the mystery of God dealing with His world. Okay? Now, that's where it says here, then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says Yahweh, Israel is my son, my firstborn. Ooh, that's a beautiful phrase. The first use of the term firstborn here in Exodus, it'll become so important in the death of the firstborn, the last plague, the commitment of the firstborn to God. Later on, the Levites will take the place of the firstborn, but they still had to be redeemed, showing God's the owner of these kids. Now, firstborn is, I think, a metaphor to show the unique relationship of Israel to the other nations of the world, as the firstborn shows the unique relationship between Jesus and his other brothers that make up the believing kingdom of God. I think this is a kind of a implicit way of saying that God loves all the nations and God wants all the nations to trust him, though there is a unique relationship with the people of Israel. Now, the fatherhood of God is mentioned often in the Old Testament, but it's always in connection with the covenant of Abraham. You might want to see Deuteronomy 1:31, Deuteronomy 8:5, Deuteronomy 32:6, Hosea 11:1, beautiful, beautiful. Isaiah 1:2, Isaiah 63:16, Jeremiah 3:19, Malachi 1:6, all mention the fatherhood of God, but not in a universal sense of creation, but in a sense of redemption through his mercy and love, and later his Messiah. Now, notice in verse 23 is mentioned that as God is, Israel is the firstborn of God, the firstborn of Pharaoh is going to die because Pharaoh is not going to listen. It's the last plague, the death of the firstborn, where all the firstborn of Egypt, in a collective sense, died, as all the firstborn of Israel, God's people, will be spared. Verse 24, it came about at the lodging place on the way, the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. I want to tell you, verse 24 through 26 has caused commentators to go berserk. Jump around, pull their hair out, because none of us know what it's talking about. We've lost the key to this thing. Apparently, God has called Moses, equipped Moses, sent Moses out. Now, on the way, God tries to kill him. There's such ambiguity here because the words him are not sure who it refers to. Is it the Lord? Now, the Septuagint says the angel of the Lord. And put him to death. Gershom, Eliezer, Moses, who's supposed to be dying here? And why? We don't know. The Lord met him in a lodging place. Now, this seems to be a typical place, probably where some water was, where caravans stopped. All the travelers stopped there. There was a lot of people camped there. That's how the protection was that night. I'm sure it was several of these along the path. The Lord met him and sought to put him to death. It seems to refer to Moses, though that can't be certain. And then Zipporah took the flint knife and cut off her son's foreskin and threw it, now mine says at Moses' feet, but Moses is not in the Hebrew text. Now, the Jews say that a demon, or the angel of the Lord, in the shape of a snake, swallowed Moses from the top down. But when he got to the circumcision, he couldn't go any further. So he came out and he tried to swallow Moses from the bottom, but he couldn't get any further than Moses' circumcision. And then Zipporah got the idea of what the problem was and circumcised her son. Well, it seems there's some disobedience here on Moses' part. Either he wasn't circumcised. That's probably not true because he grew up in a Jewish home. He probably was done to him. Maybe his son, either Gershom or the second son, was not circumcised. We're not sure. But it was a very important right to God, going back to Genesis 17:1. And Moses had not performed it the way he was supposed to. The Jews have all kinds of wild reasons of why he didn't do it to his sons, but he didn't. Maybe Zipporah didn't like this. It was, of course, all the people in this area, including the Midianites, were probably circumcised. There's just some ambiguous things here. I want to mention to you these two little books called Ancient Israel, Social Institutions and Religious Institutions. Its discussion of circumcision is so good, and you need something like this. Or one of the Bible encyclopedias that we have, like Zondervan's or the New International, will help tremendously on this kind of discussion about circumcision. We think that everybody was circumcised in this area, but usually as a passage into manhood or preparation for marriage. Maybe what Zipporah wanted to wait for, not circumcise the children young, but wait till they got married. We're just not sure. But the fact that she took a flint knife, flint's very sharp. They still circumcised with that even when metal instruments were available. And she said, now, her son is not in the text. It says it's cut off his foreskin and threw it at Moses' feet. Doesn't say Moses. Some say it touched his feet. Touched whose feet? The boy she circumcised or Moses' feet? We're not sure. Some say the word feet here is a euphemism for the male sex organ. That may be true from the book of Ruth, chapter 3, verses 4, 7, and 8, and Isaiah 6, 2, and even the Jerusalem Bible, the New Catholic English translation, even translates it that way. And she said, you are a bridegroom of blood to me. Now, what that means, we have no idea. It seems to refer something about circumcision being a rite into marriage or something. So she does three things. She gets a knife, she circumcised her son, she threw it at Moses' feet, and she says to him, you're a bridegroom of blood. So obviously, whatever happened to Moses, illness, some kind of supernatural plague coming on him, she knew what to do. Apparently they had talked about it. She acted. Whatever happened went away. There is no parallel to this. The Jews don't make a big deal about this. Nobody knows what's happening here. But it's obviously something of the importance of circumcision and something that Moses had left out, but that Zipporah knew about, and that's all we can say. Verse 26 is kind of a comment on what happened, not part of the event itself. It's a later kind of summary. Now, verse 27 and following, I think, is interesting. Now, the Lord said to Aaron, go to meet Moses in the wilderness. This is kind of out of chronological order, because God had told Moses earlier about that back in verse 14, but here's the reference to it here in the passage. Meet Moses in the wilderness. Now, the wilderness is this uninhabited pasture land. To the naked eye, it looks like this desert, but if you've ever been to the Promised Land, it's these little clumps of brown grass that grow there. It's adequate for animals that browse, like sheep or goats or camels or those kind of animals, to have enough to live on. And so it's that kind of area. And he went to meet him at the mountain of God. Now, that surprises me, because that seems to imply Mount Sinai or Mount Horeb, probably the two names for the same mountain. Sinai seems to come from the wilderness of Zin, which is not a Hebrew word, and Horeb is a Hebrew word that seems to imply the same area. Apparently, Moses met him at the place, close to the place he had met God. He went back to talk to Jethro, and now he's coming back past the mountain where the burning bush was, and his brother met him. They kissed him, typical Oriental greeting. And Moses told Aaron all the words that the Lord had said to him and all the signs that he had commanded him to do. So Moses and Aaron went and assembled all the elders of the sons of Israel. Now, they couldn't get all the people together. They got the tribal leaders together. And look at verse 30. They performed these three signs, and the people believed. So the people believed when they heard. Now, the Septuagint says they rejoiced, but the word heard fits. That the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel, that he had seen their affliction. This goes right back to chapter 3. It's a very strong affirmation of in verse 7 that God cared for his people. He was going to do whatever it took to deliver them. And here he had come down to deliver them, and they bowed low and worshipped. Now, this chapter, I think, it has some very interesting and positive things for us to communicate. Number one, that God is in control of history, that he still acts in his world in supernatural ways. He may use a natural thing, but he'll do it with supernatural timing and intensity. And number two, what God calls for, he'll equip us for. He doesn't promise us to be eloquent or real stand-out-ish. He promises to be effective for what he called us to do. Now, when we refuse, we have the free will to do that. But I want to tell you, we sometimes reap God's anger. God was angry at Moses because of his continuous excuses. And I think us in the same condition, we always feel inadequate, which is healthy, but it can be overdone. This thing on sovereignty and free will is probably the most significant theological truth in this chapter. But I want to say again to you, it's only significant to Western mentality. There was no problem to the Jews in this passage about God hardening Pharaoh's heart. They never thought about that bothering them. They never thought about it being unfair, because God was the source for everything. Only one causality in the universe, the Creator, Redeemer, Holy One of Israel. And so the fact that God is manipulating events in history and manipulating people would not bother them the least. It's our problem looking at it from the New Testament about did the man have adequate opportunity to trust the Lord? Is it unfair that God's sovereignty would overrun his ability to choose? And, of course, only when you put it in that kind of dichotomy does problems arise. Paul seemed to be make this statement in Romans chapter 9. But, again, Paul saw from this Hebrew mentality that God was in control of all things. I don't think we can settle this issue. I simply think the Bible makes both affirmations, that God is sovereign, and nothing exists that is not in his will, even evil. But God has allowed man to truly have a freedom, an independent will that God allows to function. I think God is eternally present. He is not no past, present, and future. And although he knows, I do not believe in determinism that says that I'm just, I have no choice in my own life. Everything I do is just predetermined by my parents and my heredity and where I was born and all that. No, I think we do have some degree of choice, though it's obvious we're influenced by many, many things. We cannot solve this tension, but I think using Pharaoh as a major problem of trusting God is very unfortunate, because it reads too much of our Western thinking back into a Hebrew book. And so I want you to think very clearly on that. There's some Look up predestination and free will in the Bible Encyclopedia as you look up circumcision, and I think you'll understand this historical tension between first in Paul and then developed into Augustine and Pelagius and later on in Calvin and Arminius. I think both of them have biblical truth, and it's unfortunate we try to pick one over the other. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.